It's like I was having a pipe then, see that? Sorry. I've done that a few times. My name's Ralph, I'm an addict. Hi, Ralph. Sorry about that. I think this is the second time I've spoken to a microphone in an NA meeting. The first time was in Greece, I think it was about 2003. I was at a European convention. And this guy was standing up chairing, and he was sharing on step 6 and 7. For those of you who don't know what steps and 6, 7 are, neither do I. He was sharing about how he perceived himself and how he viewed himself and how the outside world saw him. And I really identified with it, with what he was saying. What he was basically saying is that he feels like he was a freak. He feels like he was a mistake. Whatever he did was wrong. I feel really nervous. Whatever he did was wrong. It never amounted to nothing. And I really identified with that. And I suppose with regards to that, there's been a little bit of change. I still don't feel that what I do is enough. Who I am is enough. What I have is enough. What I look like is enough. How I speak is enough. Actually, everything about me, I don't think is enough. And I don't know where that comes from. I'll tell you when it was. It was about 4 weeks ago tonight. I was sat in the chair at the back there, and I was sat next to my friend Richard. And I got a voicemail message from my ex-partner's mum. You know, I could see it flashing as I pulled it out of my pocket, the phone, and it said on this voicemail message that, congratulations, Ralph, your son was born tonight. He weighed £7.25, and, you know, congratulations, all that usual stuff. And he was the happiest day in my life, without a shadow of a doubt. And it happened in here. You know, the sad part of it was I wasn't there. Her mum was her birth partner. And, you know, I went and saw that my baby the next day and held him in my arms. And I looked at him and I thought, you know, I don't know. I can't remember what I thought, but it was like, you know, this person I'm holding in my hands, you know, and I sort of got to know him over the next couple of days. He doesn't care, you know, who's looking at him. He doesn't care if he farts in front of you. He doesn't care whether he shits himself, whether he cries, you know, who's around. He just doesn't care. And I was like that. I didn't care if you were around if I farted. I didn't care if my shit stunk. I didn't care. I had this same way of being as this my baby did. And I suppose as time went on, that changed. I don't know how it changed. I don't know why it changed, but it did. What you thought of me, how you see me, became really important. And I don't know how that happened. I don't know where I went, why I started off with that. It was just that, you know, I've never felt enough. I don't know why. I don't know why I'm an addict, for starters. I ain't going to go down that road. I think millions of man hours of research have gone into that. I still don't think they've come up with an answer. But I'll tell you my story. I spoke to my sponsor a couple of times about doing this chair. And he just said to me, tell your story, and that's what I'm going to do. I can't tell anybody else's. And I'll just try and be as honest as I can. I'm originally from West London. Grew up in an area called... It depends who I'm talking to. I either say I'm from Notting Hill. If I'm speaking to people from like my people of where I'm from, it's Ladbroke Grove. Anyway, I'm actually from. I was born in Chiswick and I grew up in West London. And I suppose that'll do. I'm the third youngest of three boys, and I've got a younger sister. Mum and dad are still together. And growing up in my house was, what's the word? Difficult. Well, I didn't know at the time it was difficult because I didn't know of any other way. I never had no idea that it was difficult. all unknown. It was very tense, very, very, I don't know what the word is. I was just really scared. My dad was this big man, 6'3", had a fucking big beard. You know, very angry, really angry. That's what I remember anyway. And he used to knock my mum about. She was always wearing big dark glasses. He was either knocking my other brother about or I was getting a slap. And I always resented my sister for not getting clumped. I don't know why, but I just did. And I'm doing step four at the moment. I'm writing about some of this stuff. It's really quite difficult. I can actually put myself back there if I tried. So I grew up. Or did I? Did I grow up? I don't know if I grew up. I'll tell you what I did do. I just went into I'm sort of beginning to see as I'm writing down my inventory that what I actually did is I went into fantasy land. I was zoned out. I started to eat. I started to talk to myself, isolate in my bedroom. And it was very difficult. You know, and it isn't about blame. I want to get that across to people who may be new to this fellowship. I don't blame my parents for what happened to me. I don't blame my brothers or my sister. My mum and dad gave me what they got. I never went without food. I never went without clothes. I went to school. Went on a couple of holidays down to Dymchurch. But what I can see looking back now, what I didn't get was the things that Ralph needs. I don't know about anybody else, what I needed, you know, and that was to be loved, to be, I suppose, nurtured, given healthy boundaries, given, you know, a healthy upbringing. I never got that. And the net result is, you know, I sit here today, I still don't know untrue. I do know what a healthy boundary is. I just find it difficult to stick to them sometimes. I went to school, then I went to my secondary school, and my experience was that the first school I went to, my primary school, was primarily, you know, I was primarily around certain people. And what I mean by that, the majority of those people were white. They were white people. But my secondary school, the majority of them were black people, and for some reason, and due to my upbringing and the input from my parents and my peers, for some reason these people were to be feared. And I grew up fearing these people, and I grew up with racist views. You know, I'll sit here and I'll say that. You know, that's my experience. I grew up with racist views, and I find it really difficult to share this, but this is the way it went. This is the way it was for me. I grew up with these racist points of view, and I saw certain people as the enemy for some reason. That isn't the case today. I need to say that. A lot of, you know, I was homophobic, I was racist, sexist. And I don't know why that is. I don't know why that is. But today, you know, my sponsor's a gay man. You know, it's the old one. A lot of my best friends are black. But it's true. One of my closest friends is black. But that was the way it was. I went to this school, I was very scared, and I was, you know, and I suppose when you're scared and when you're vulnerable, people pick up on it. And what happened to me was I was really badly bullied in school. I had money taken off me. Money was demanded of me for when I, you know, people used to say to me, bring money into school. You know, it was all that stuff, so I stayed away. I was overweight. I was abused because of that, not only at home, but at school too. And I wanted desperately to fit in. Desperately to fit in. And I couldn't. I couldn't fit in for whatever reason. I think the first drug I tried was cannabis. No, actually, it was whiskey. And I first had a drop of whiskey in my mate's house. My mate's actually in this room tonight. He was 30 days clean yesterday. And he said to me, make sure you get a mentioning for me. He said, there's your mention, Frank. we raided his dad's whiskey cabinet and... yeah. Fucking horrible it was, really strong. About 90-odd percent proof or something. Anyway. It's funny, I always remember the first time I took a particular drug. Always remember it. You know, I took had my first shot of alcohol in my mate's house. I had my first joint in the Sutton's Estate in West London. I had my first acid at an acid house party. Sunrise it was. It was in a big aircraft hangar in, I think it was in Reading or somewhere like that. It was in an aircraft hangar. That was a night I'll never forget. My first ecstasy pill was in the Mud Club, Tottenham Court Road. I had my first line of coke in Daley Thompson House, just off the Portobello Road. Someone gave me a bit, go on their tube of smack. I wasn't really that much into smack. I had a couple of smokes on it in my brother's bedroom. And I had my first lick of what I can only describe as my best friend for 10 years in Cambridge Gardens in West London. I was in a room of people, it was like a circle of people. And there was a pregnant woman, 8-month pregnant woman in the corner. And they was passing this little Jack Daniels thing round, and they were smoking this stuff off of it, and I was just sitting there having lines of coke. I weren't really into this stuff that they called wash rock. But I had to go. I couldn't wait for it to get back round to me. I couldn't wait. I couldn't wait. And, you know, consequently, I had a relationship with that substance for 10 years. And, you know, it's interesting, when Roz asked us at the start of the meeting to remember where we you know, why we're here and where we come from, where that took me, that particular drug on this occasion, that I remember when people say that at the start of a meeting is, I was on the balcony of my nan's house, where my nan lives. She lives in this sheltered accommodation unit in West London. And it was Boxing Day, probably about 97, 98. No, 96, 97, anyway. Boxing Day, she was down my mum's because she used to spend Christmas down at my mum's house, and I'm on her balcony letting myself into her house with my mum's keys, about to steal money out of her house to feed my habit, you know, to buy more crack. I always remember when the secretary of a meeting says that, I'm on that balcony just about letting myself in, because that's where I go. And the things I did for that drug, I just, you know, it's crackers. It really is mad. You know, I was saying to my friend Corrado today that, you know, he was in his car, and I remember an instance that I look back on it and I have to laugh. But when I was doing it, it was mad. It was mad. I used to smoke with this fella, Keith, God bless his soul. He committed suicide. He took his own life. I don't know why. I heard stories about it, but he took his life. But he used to put tickets. Cards into phone boxes. His mum used to work in a brothel and stuff, and he used to put the cards out, and he used to come to me and he wanted to buy crack. So I used to smoke with him, and this occasion he'd left me in his flat. And what I'd done this evening, I'd done all the money, I'd done whatever money I had, whatever money I had to take back to my girlfriend. So I'm lying in his front room, and I thought to myself, oh, we need a new three-piece suite. Me and Nicola, we need a three-piece suite. I'm lying on this fella's sofa. He ain't here, he's gone. He's gone somewhere. So what I proceeded to do, he lived on about the 8th floor of this tower block. I put my Pickford uniform on. I started picking up all this furniture out of his front room. So I took his sofa out into the landing, the chair, and the other chair. Put the sofa in the lift, went down with that, took that outside, went back, got the other chair, and then the other chair, took them down in the lift. So I'm down on the ground floor now, right? Where shall I go? I know, I'll go over the footbridge, over the railway. So it's about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, pranged out my head, thinking, oh, this is going to appease her when I get home. You know, I've got no money, but I've got a three-piece suite. So I'm walking down the road with this three-seater sofa on my head. I go up the stairs, go over the footbridge. I get it onto the other side of the footbridge. I go back for a chair, and I bring that, and I go back for the other chair, and I bring that back. And I get to Westbourne Park Road. and she lives on Colville Gardens. I'm about a third of the way there. As I've got this thing on my head, you know, the car pulls up next to me really slow, and he's like, "What are you up to, mate?" "It's a policeman." "I found it, mate. I found it up there." I pointed to where the other two chairs were, because they were next to this tree. I said, "Someone's left them there." It's like, "Well, I've had a result. Look at it." Fuck, it was lovely. It was a lovely three-piece suite. So anyway, he's nicked me. Surprise, surprise, he's arrested me for theft. And, you know, Keith's mum reported it stolen, you know, and I go to court. It was when Knightsbridge was closed. I had to go to Borough Crown Court, and I got fined £300. And, fucking hell, what a nightmare. Yeah. Can laugh at it now. Really can. I can laugh about what, you know, those sort of things. But, at the time, it wasn't funny, because I was just desperate. I was a desperado. I'd do anything, you know, to sort of smooth the path back into... Because I knew if I'd have gone back to the house, she wouldn't have let me in. Because what I used to discover is I'd go back to the flat where we both lived, and I'd be greeted to a sight of, you know, because she lived in this flat, and there was a courtyard. I don't know if any of you know Colville Gardens, just by the tabernacle, by the church, there's this big, like, walkway. And I used to walk around the corner, and I used to see all my clothes just sprawled, they're just scattered all over the... She'd just sling them out the second floor window, my trainers, and they'd be ripped up. And so I used to try and smooth my way back in, you know, I'd call up to the window, and she'd say, you got any money, you got any rent? And I'd be like, yeah, just let us in. As soon as I got upstairs, it'd be like, well, what it is, love, what it is. And that was the favourite one, what it is. What I've done is I've given it to Paul in the pub to look after, and of course it'd gone, I'd smoked it all. And another occasion, I used to smoke with this fella called Alex, you know, and Alex isn't in a bad way. He got sectioned a couple of weeks ago in a secure mental home, and I used to smoke with him. So I was pretty close to that sort of stuff, I guess. And all the money is gone. We've got nothing, you know. I asked, my drug of choice was crack. That was mine. I'd never had... My drug of choice wasn't more. It wasn't what you've got. It was crack. And I loved it. And, you know, when you just sit there and it's like, what can you conjure up? What rabbit can you pull out of the hat to get some more? I'm just sitting there like that. And I just gazed over to Alex. And I can see him. He's got the you know, the asthma inhaler. He's got one of them, and he's smoking on something. I said to him, "What are you smoking, mate?" He went, "One of me bogies." He was smoking one of his bogies, and he even asked me for one of mine, because he believed that where the smoke was going up his nose, it was going onto his bogies, and he was smoking one. Bogies, eh? I've smoked cheese and toenails and crisp and that. I've never smoked a bogey. So anyway, I'm off. No. The night, I think it was about around late 98, you know, towards the end of 98, it was really bad for me. It was, you know, desperate. I wasn't washing. I lost my job. I had quite a good job. I was managing to hold that together, but where I wasn't turning up, they just said to me, "Look, we've got to let you go." I just went flat out then. I was hanging around where this guy Alex lived, and, you know, used to sit outside on the wall late at night, just hoping that someone was going to come along with something, you know, to bring me in, break me something off. Because towards the end, I've got to be honest with you, I turned into some of my friends back in West London might have said I've always been a ponce, but I just turned into a proper ponce. You know, it was like I never had the courage or the is it courage? Is it courage to go out stealing? I don't know. I never had the will to go out and do anything. However, one night, it was one night, Saturday afternoon, a couple of people come storming down to the basement where he lived, come in, and they pulled out a wallet, and it transpired that what they'd done is they'd robbed a cab driver at knife point, and they'd robbed him of his wallet and his, you know, his stuff. And what happened was, a couple of nights later, I was sitting there, you know, again trying to think of something where, you know, I could pull a rabbit out of the hat, etc. And I thought to myself, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to do what they did the other night. I'm going to go and rob a cab driver. I'm not laughing at it. What happened was, I used to work for this removal firm, and this removal firm had quite a distinctive uniform. This removal firm, and it was purple trousers and a blue jacket with the name emblazoned across the chest. So what I thought I'd do is I'd rob a cab driver in this uniform. You know, I'd no money left. I remember he had this ceremonial dagger in his front room, and I put that down my trousers, and I rang one up to his fictional address around the corner, picked me up, and I took him somewhere and I robbed him. And I did that a further five times. And the reason why I'm sharing that is that what towards the end of my using, I'd borrowed from everybody. I hadn't stolen from everybody, so I never had the arsehole to go out thieving. I've got to be honest with you, I never had the courage to commit crime and all that sort of stuff, because prison scared me. But I did this because I was desperate. And what started to happen is, you know, I went up this other guy's house, and he said to me, "Ralph, look, you seen the paper?" And in the local paper there was a clipping about this guy who'd robbed this cab driver, and I got really scared. And I realised the game was up, so what I did is I called my drug worker, who I was working with a couple of years previous, and I said to her, "Look, I need help." Her name was Angela, I think. "I need help. I'm robbing people at knife point. I've got to get out of here. I've got to go to rehab. Help me." Actually, I didn't say I've got to go to rehab. I didn't know what a rehab was. I didn't know there were places like that. She said to me, "Come and see me." So I went and saw her. And one morning, you know, I was lying on this fella's sofa, and I hadn't washed, and I was unshaven. I was in a bad way, real bad way. I stunk. And I opened my eyes, and standing over me was my ex-girlfriend, Nicola. And she said to me, "Come and get up, you're coming with me." And I said, "What for?" Because she'd, not a couple of weeks previous, she'd slung all my clothes down, what clothes I'd left, down the basement, and said, "You know, you're out in your ear, you crackhead." And she said, "You're coming with me." Basically, she took me back to the flat. I had a bath, I had a shave, she cooked me something to eat. And as I got out of the bath, my brother was standing there. My brother, who is now in recovery, he came into recovery about a year after I got clean. And he said to me, "You know, you've got to come down to Mum's. I'm taking you down Mum's." And my mum and my dad had disowned me. They'd fucked me off long ago. And they brought me down to the house. And it was like, I got into the kitchen, my mum was sat there, and I was sat at the kitchen table. My dad came down, it was like, I got up to give him an hug, and he said, "No, just stay away from me, get away from me. I don't trust you, I don't like you, and I don't trust you." And he said, "Just do what you got, go and do what you got to go and do." So for 2 weeks, I stayed in my mum and dad's house. I got, every day my brother bought me 4 tins of Stella and a lump of Draw. And I used to sit in my room playing PlayStation, smoking Draw, drinking Stella. And 22nd of February 1999, I left on a train from Paddington, and I went to Western Supermare. And I went to treatment. Aren't you since? If I'm honest, I didn't want to get clean. I didn't want to get clean. The reason why I got out of where I lived is because I thought I was going to go away for a long time. That's why I went, you know, got out of town, basically. You know, and I was speaking to my friend on the phone this morning about, you know, having God do for you what you can't do for yourself. Do you remember Corrado? I suppose that's what happened to me. You know, God intervened, took me out of where I lived, put me somewhere I was safe, and said to me, "Here you go." And what I did that night when I got into the treatment centre is I got shown to my room. I didn't want to mingle with anybody. As far as I was concerned, it was all carrot crunching bumpkins. I didn't want anything to do with them. They weren't from where I was from. They had nothing for me and they couldn't help me. So I was quite open-minded, as you can probably tell. And what I did, when I got to my room, because we was opposite a church, I got on my knees and I knelt by the bed and I said, whoever you are, please help me. Please. And I ain't been let down. I ain't been let down once. Life has happened. Things have happened in my life that, you know, that happens to everyone out there. Life comes along, you know. My ex-partner, who I was engaged to marry, who was pregnant with my child, she called it off after 3 months being pregnant. We're still apart. She lives on the other side of the country. I get to see my son. Well, I've seen him 4 times since he's been born. I want to see him every day. When I come home from work, I want to see him. I want to hold him, I want to feed him, I want to change his nappies, but I can't. And the reason why that is because she decided to call it off and there's nothing I can do about it. And that's why I hate the powerlessness of this, you know, of me. I hate my powerlessness. I suppose that's why I'm so controlling, is I hate being powerless. What happened for me in that treatment centre is I got some clean time. And I got introduced to Narcotics Anonymous through H&I. And for those people who don't know what H&I is, it's hospitals and institutions. They're people from Narcotics Anonymous who go into treatment centres, detoxes, prisons, places where NA isn't freely available to people. And we take meetings into these places. And 2 people came in. They brought this fella from London called Mark, who was about 5 years at the time. And he told a story, and I'd really identified with it. And his story was about isolation, degradation, and fear. And I knew about all 3 of them. And I thought, yeah, I'll have a go at this when I come out. And I went to my first meeting, outside meeting, Friday night step meeting in Weston, got my 6-month key ring. And my second meeting was on a Wednesday, it was electric chair. And a fella called Lee come up to me after, and he'd done the newcomer bit with me, welcomed me, he said, keep coming back. And he spent some time with me. We went to the gym together. He used to buy me breakfast and that and looked after me. And I think it says somewhere in the literature, you remember when you say you are. And I don't remember when I said I was a member. But I knew from that, around that point on, that this was working. This was something that could work for me. There was nothing back in West London for me. All I knew in West London was using and drugs and people who, in all honesty, used to walk around like they were fucking gangsters. And I used to think I was a gangster. You know, I used to bowl about, screwing people out, giving it. I'm so scared, it's unbelievable. You can make a song about it. It could be the chorus. I'm so scared. I'm so scared. And I always wanted to be one of those people, you know, because there are people around my way who have this sort of, you know, aura about, well, I don't know fucking whether it's an aura. They've just got this reputation and they're people to be feared. And I used to be scared of these people and it was like, I felt so sure. I really did. I was no good at thieving. I was no good at fighting. I used to pick on little fellas. That's what I was like. I was writing my step one. It was like what I got up to when I was drunk. I was a liberty taker. I took liberties with little people than me. And I'm, as you can see, I'm not that small. So I always took the easy option. You know, I did that throughout my, you know, when I was stealing. I used to steal from my parents and my family because I knew they wouldn't nick me. It was the easy option for me. And I have to say that in Narcotics Anonymous, I haven't taken the easy option. I've got involved. I've got myself. I've always had a sponsor. I've been clean for 7 years and 3 months. I've always had a sponsor since far back as I can remember. My present sponsor is, well, what can I say? Yeah, I don't have to say. I know what he is. He's taken me through these steps in another way. And You know, he doesn't say to me, you have to be grateful, Ralph. He doesn't say to me, you have to work with newcomers. He doesn't say to me, you have to. He just says to me, be who you are, because you're enough. That's what he says to me. And I love him for that. Doesn't try to come over as this sort of dictatorial, you know, addict who thinks what he knows is better than what you do. I love him for it. I had a dictator at home when I was growing up, and don't want another one. And I've always been involved with service. I've always had a service commitment. I sponsor people. I sponsor one person at the moment, and I'm trying to. And I do find it difficult. I've got to be honest with you. My sponsor, he came round last week, and we sort of got engaged in this little battle. And my sponsor said, "Well, perhaps it's just about listening to him, Ralph. Just listen to him. Don't try and get into a conflict with him. He just wants to be heard, perhaps, like you did." And I do find it difficult. Steps. Step. I'm doing step four at the moment. And for those people who might be new to the program, they ain't as scary as they look. They're not. They're really not as scary as they look. As my sponsor points out to me, they're actually healing you, Ralph, while you're working them. It doesn't feel like it at the time. It doesn't feel like I'm being healed. What it actually feels like is I'm punishing myself because I'm revealing all this stuff again. I'm opening it up. You know, I used to say that, you know, when I went into treatment, I sort of opened the door, had a little look in at my past and shut it again when I left. But I'm opening it up again, and I'm actually taking people in this room with me. My sponsor, my friends. You know, people I listen to in meetings. I ain't going anywhere. I know I can't use. The sponsor tells me I can use. I choose not to use. Because I can. And if I did, I won't make it back. I'm a firm believer in that. You know, I actually believe if I relapse, and this is a belief that I have, if I relapse, I'll kill myself. I can't go back to that. I can. I'm choosing not to. What else can I say about this program? I've met people in this fellowship that I didn't think I would meet. Friends I've made. Support I've received. You know, there's people in this fellowship who have no idea of the impact they've had on my recovery. No idea. You know, when I used to go to conventions, and again, for those people who don't know what a convention is, it's a celebration of recovery. It could happen over a weekend, and people are invited to come and talk, and you know, marathon meetings, and there's entertainment, a disco, and it, you know, they're really good things to get involved in. And there's one coming up in Birmingham in July. There's one in Bournemouth in June. And there's one in Portugal at the end of July, isn't there, Corrado? We're going, aren't we? And I remember going to these conventions and listening to these people they used to bring over from America. And I was spellbound. Absolutely spellbound with these speakers. Like fucking Billy Graham of Narcotics Anonymous used to bring them over, and it was amazing. The 2000 London convention, I come up to London to attend it. It was my first London convention. It was called Recovery 2000. I don't know what I've done with the T-shirt. And my brother was admitted to hospital that weekend, so he couldn't come to the convention. His leg used to blow up quite regular, and he had to go to Paddington Hospital. And what happened for me over the period of that weekend is I got friendly with this girl. And what happened was she couldn't make it back to the convention. She rang me up. She said, "Look, I'm not coming to the disco on the Friday night, and I ain't coming to the convention the next day." In fact, I haven't seen her since. I don't know where she went, but how I took that is that, you know, she was rejecting me. That's how I was so fucking wrapped up in myself. She probably just wanted to go off and have a drink or something. I took it as she rejected me. Anyway, with all these feelings, you know, I go up and see my brother. And a couple of days prior, someone who from around my area had seen me and he'd heard I'd got into treatment. He said to me, "I'm fucking really proud of you. You've done really well. Give me £100. Give me £100." I put it in my pocket and it was burning an hole in my pocket all this weekend. And I was standing at Paddington Station because what I was going to do, I'd left the hospital. I weren't going back to the convention. It was about 4 or 5 o'clock Saturday night. And I was going to go down and see Alex, the guy who I used to use with. I was going to go down and show him how well I was doing. You know that one? I don't know what would have happened if I'd have gone down there, but what happened was I was standing at the bus stop waiting to get number 7 down to Ladbroke Grove to go and see Alex, and there was this bus, and next to the bus was a Mercedes, and the driver of the Mercedes was looking out through the passenger seat talking to the bus driver. Now, for those of you who don't know Paddington, it's quite a way away from Holland Park, and I don't know what the hell this fella was doing in Paddington, but what actually happened is I went round to the other side of the car. I said, "What's happening?" He said, "Where's this fucking convention?" I said, "So I'll take you." So I took him to the convention. As soon as I got in, this fella called Carly Shed, from New York, and blew me away. Again, there's God doing for me what I can't do for myself. I was going to use that day. No two ways about it. Because one of the feelings, among others, that I can't handle is rejection. Can't handle it. I don't like it. And I'd rather kick it up the street away from me than have it. I don't want it. And that's what I was going to do that night. I strongly believed that. I went into this thing. He was speaking. And he spoke for a good... He went over about an hour, I think. I got it on tape at home somewhere. But it was magic. And, yeah, that's... You know, I suppose I've got a minute or so left just to say to Simon, thanks for asking me to come and do this tonight. Leading up to this year, all week, I've been all right about it. As soon as it came to the 10-minute break, that was me, I was gone, shitting myself. And Frankie gave me an hug and just said, you know, because I was everywhere, I didn't know what to do. But if you'd have told me on February the 21st, 1999, that in 7 years' time, you'll be in Trafalgar Square in like a drop-in centre for people who are having it hard, so to speak, and you'll be speaking in front of about 50 people talking about yourself, I'd have told you to piss off. But that's what's happened tonight, and Narcotics Anonymous is responsible for that. You know, I'm a Narcotics Anonymous member. I don't go anywhere else. I used to, early in recovery. I'll tell you what happened. One of my mates went to an AA meeting and was told that he couldn't share what he was sharing there. And could he shut up? And they talk about piggyback resentments. I got on that and I ain't been back. And I'm really glad I ain't, because I've got one illness. I only go to one fellowship. And that isn't to sound controversial, it's my experience. I don't have to go anywhere else right now. So with that to leave, I'll leave that with you anyway. Thanks for letting me share. Thank you.